Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm Avi Stamen, co-host of the Scholarly Communication podcast. In addition to hosting Scholarly Communication, I'm the founder and CEO of Academic Language Experts, an author services company dedicated to helping scholars elevate their manuscripts prior to publication and grant proposals to receive research funding. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Mushtaq Bilal. Mushtaq Bilal is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Southern Denmark's Hans Christian Andersen Center. He holds a PhD in comparative literature from Binghamton University. His work has appeared in prestigious academic journals such as the Journal of World Literature and Comparative Literature Studies, as well as in popular publications like the Washington Post and the LA Times. Mushtaq has an online audience of more than 185,000 followers on Twitter. No, I did not misspeak. And more than 30,000 followers on LinkedIn, where he writes about simplifying the process of academic writing. He is frequently invited to deliver talks at leading universities in the US, Europe, and South Asia. His Twitter threads, have been translated into Portuguese, Japanese, Spanish, Bahasa Indonesian, and are forthcoming in several others. He lives in Odense, Denmark. Mushtaq, thank you so much for joining me today. I have to say, I'm really excited for this interview.
Thank you. Thank you, Avi. Thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Fantastic. And I can actually tell our audience that the reason that I came across Mushtaq was because there were so many people in my LinkedIn feed who were sharing his posts. And I think that's probably the best sign real organic success is when people want to share content. So it's well deserved. So, but maybe I want to take a step back for a minute and you can take me back and tell us a little bit about yourself and your academic background.
Yeah, about myself. I was born in Pakistan. I worked there for the first 32 years of my life. And then I got a grant to do my PhD in Binghamton University, New York. And then I went there, left the job that I was doing at the time. And then I went to the US, started my PhD, finished my PhD in 2022 last year, and then moved back to Pakistan for a few months before getting my postdoc. And then I moved to Odense here in Denmark just before Christmas last year.
Wow, fantastic. And tell us kind of maybe how did you get, where you obviously have a strong academic background and it sounds like you're still quite heavily involved in, research. I guess, how did you go from just kind of doing research for yourself and figuring things out on your own to thinking, well, maybe I should share some of what I'm learning along the way with others?
Yeah, it was... when I submitted my dissertation last year, last April, my wife said that I should go on Twitter. And before my wife asked me to go, to make an account, I used to be really horrified of Twitter and social media in general. And, I understand when people tell me that, they don't want to be on Twitter or on any social media platform. Because there is this stereotypical image of social media as a toxic cesspool. So I had that stereotypical image, but my wife really, you know, forced me to, she literally stood next to my desk and, you know, she made me open an account on Twitter. And then I realized that once I started my account on Twitter, it took me like 2 to 3 days to post a tweet. I didn't know what to do with it. But then I thought to myself that, hey, Mushtaq, you have a PhD in comparative literature and my dissertation is on the genre of novel. So, and I have a fairly good understanding of how genres, literary genres, you know, worked, especially during the 19th century in various parts of the world. So I said to myself, hey, Mushtaq, how about you treat Twitter as a literary genre and try to figure it out? And from then on, from there on, I was able to extrapolate, you know, whatever I had learned was very portable, you know, because all the things that I had learned in literary theory, I could easily apply to good use on Twitter. And I very quickly figured out, it was, you know, like in a couple months, I was able to figure out, I was able to deconstruct how Twitter works, how content on Twitter works. And the good thing about Twitter is that it's a text-based platform, one of the very few text-based platforms in, you know, which has such a global reach. If you look at other platforms like YouTube or TikTok with such a big reach, or even Facebook, they are not text-based. You know, they're partially text-based when it comes to a platform like Facebook. But with Twitter, it's mostly text-based, and that is, you know, that really helped me, you know, transfer my skills, writing skills that I had developed while doing my PhD to an online platform. So I started writing about, So I started writing about my own processes. During my PhD, I had taken a bunch of writing workshops and, you know, seminars on the process of writing. And so I said that, you know, if I write about the 19th century novel, not many people are going to read about that because that's, you know, really dense literary theory. But if I write about the writing process, how you conceive a project, develop a project, you know, draft it, revise it, seek feedback on it, that would be, you know, very useful for my colleagues, and especially for people who were just starting their PhDs. And I started writing about that, and then I went to Pakistan, and then I wanted to teach my students Zotero, the reference management system, the app. And I prepared a tutorial for them, and I didn't have access to the online learning management system, the LMS the university was using. So I said, well, it'll take a week or so to get me access, so how about I post the tutorial on my Twitter? And I posted the tutorial and it went like viral. It was, I had like 3,000, I think 3,000 or 4,000 followers, 5,000 max followers at the time. And the Twitter thread went viral. It was like 2 to 3 million views. And, you know, it didn't stop for the next 48 hours. And I was so surprised. I was like, my God, this is a tutorial about how to reference, you know, how to create citations and references. And there are so many people who want to learn. So that got me, you know, that really opened my eyes to this kind of content, that, you know, there is a market for this kind of content. People want to learn. And, you know, I could write this. And so that's the long and short of it. Not the long, but the short of it.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I think there's so many things that are amazing about that story. Two things that jump out to me. One is the fact that you actually saw how you could use your theoretical academic background for social, which I think is totally the exact opposite of what most academics I speak to say. Well, you know, being active on socials is so different from what I'm doing in my research that it just like almost feels like the opposite end of the spectrum. So the fact you were able to kind of take that and run with it is A. And then B, what I think is amazing is that I think it just comes to show us how desperate researchers are to understand best practices with writing, and how I guess we're failing to teach academic writing in a way that's modern and contemporary and meaningful and practical, to the point where people are searching for these alternative sources of, you know, helpful content, which clearly you're supplying them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the idea that, and I'm talking here from the perspective of somebody who didn't like this social media. I understand the place where these professors are coming from, and that the, and the place is that of rigidity and closed-mindedness, and the place is that of, you know, hey, we are doing this and we don't want to treat social media like this. Is the conventional wisdom in academia is that social media is something beneath us, that we talk in very high-minded or high language of literary scholarship or any scholarship, you know, of research jargon, and that if we were to go and post about it on social media, people will not understand. The tricky part here is that it takes an enormous amount of skill to distill your scholarly findings into a language that is comprehensible for non-specialists. It takes a lot of skill. And I used to practice this when I was in Binghamton. I would go for a swim every morning. I used to swim in early mornings, and I would go to the YMCA, and there people would sometimes, you know, when you go to a swimming pool like the Y, you'll find a few regulars, and, you know, you start talking about them and they'll ask you, hey, Mushtaq, what do you do? And I used to take that opportunity to perfect my elevator pitch for my dissertation. And it took months and months of, you know, iterations to bring down the elevator pitch to a level where it could be comprehensible outside of a comparative literature department. So this is like, if you become rigid that, you know, what I'm writing is high, you know, is rarefied research, and that people are not able to access that unless you initiate them into a scholarly discourse. I think that is... And I mean, you can also understand it in terms of, you know, protecting your turf. People want to protect their turf. That is also understandable. But then what somebody like me thinks is that, you know, then you're not democratizing education or, you know, access to research. So this is one point. The second point, what was your second point?
Well, yeah, I was saying...
And you are absolutely right. 100%, I am with you. Because the process of academic writing, especially at the level of PhD and dissertations and monographs, is so mystified. You don't know how... you go to a PhD program and they're like, hey, you have to do this. You have to write a dissertation. How? But how? I mean, everybody learns it by doing it. So will you. But this is not how it is done. You know, it's a there is a book by... There's a book called Writing Your Journal Article in 12 Weeks. It is by Wendy Laura Belcher. And in the start of her book, she says that publishing a journal article or writing scholarship is a game. And you know, you have to know the rules of the game in order to play it. And that was a big revelation for me. You know, you have to understand it in terms of a game. And if you do, then, you know, things start becoming demystified.
Yeah. There's so much truth to that. I found that when I started speaking to lecturers, you know, about academic writing, there's one thing is understanding kind of the outline of what a typical article looks like, right? The IMRAD structure, if you're in the social sciences, but there's so much more to publishing that has nothing to do with, you know, with that, but it has to do with unwritten rules around this that are not really taught. You know, I had an academic writing teacher write to me the other day because she couldn't figure out how to publish her article, right? So there's this gap there between the writing and the publishing. But even in the writing sense, I think you're absolutely right. And the other thing I wanted to kind of follow up with you about is, it's interesting that you're mentioning about making research accessible to others, but it seems like from your work online, it is making research accessible to others, but it's also making that process easier for the researchers themselves to understand what the rules of that game are.
Yeah, to an extent, yes. Somebody like me can write that this is how a piece of scholarship gets conceived and, you know, developed. For other researchers, other researchers will have to do two things if they want to, you know, make use of the content that somebody like me or other you know, creators like myself, they do. One is to be open to the possibility that you can learn something from Twitter or something from LinkedIn. That's a big, you know, that's a big mindset shift. That's a paradigm shift, you know. And I know this because I underwent this, you know, during the last, not during the second half of the last year. I underwent this and I realized that there is this huge, enormous opportunity that scholars, educators, teachers can use, and this for some reason they think that it's, if you talk about citing a YouTube video in your article, there are very high chances that 9 times out of 10 people will not take that citation very seriously, because people would be like, hey, what is YouTube, you know, cite a journal article from I don't know, New Literary Theory, or you know, Diacritics, or Comparative Literature Studies. So there is this intellectual snobbery. There is no doubt about it. If we can get past that, I think there's an enormous possibility and, you know, opportunity for people like us and others to help democratize education.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you, especially within the context. I think, you know, we kind of take it for granted that when we're talking about research and scholarship, we're thinking about the people who have already succeeded, right? We're generally thinking about the people who are at the top of their game. Well, they figured out the rules, so they had to work hard and blood, sweat, and tears to get there. Well, then everyone should have to do that. But I think that we would all agree that, you know, when I read a stat that shocked me recently, which was that 50% of researchers publish one article and never publish again in their lives. Well, and then stop becoming researchers. I mean, then maybe they get their PhD, but they don't continue down the path. And I think that should give us some pause for thought to think about, well, is that because they all 50% of them had a great experience, but, you know, decided they wanted to do other things with their lives? Or did they actually, you know, did they see it as a challenge they couldn't overcome and a failure, and therefore they couldn't move on? But anyway, that's a question for another time. I'm curious if you can kind of think back about a post maybe that wasn't as successful, or a post that you know, from the beginning of your time when you started posting, where you're like, oh, you know what, I tried something out and it didn't work. Are there any of those that you can kind of share with us, that, and what learnings and, you know, kind of lessons you took away from those?
Yeah. Initially, when I started writing, there weren't any posts that people would find useful, because when I started, I didn't know how to orient myself on social media. My approach was me-centric. My approach was not the reader-centric. And if you're writing something for self-pleasure or for, you know, telling the world how great you are, not many people are going to consume that kind of, you know, content, or they're not going to find that content useful. It's not that what I learned out of those initial posts, because I was writing and I was reading at the same time, you know, how other people who, big creators on, you know, on Twitter, especially within the academic Twitter, I was looking at how those people are, you know, how those people are creating content and the kind of content they were creating. So there is, of course, there is advice and, you know, recommendations and prescriptions on, or how-tos. But initially, I wrote for months and months and none of the posts would go anywhere, because I was trying to figure it out. So yeah, there were like, I don't remember, if I start listing them, it will take like 40 minutes. All of 40 minutes would be consumed in those, you know, in those failed posts.
Yeah. 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 It's so interesting, because I've seen a lot of, I actually was, you know, I can share a similar story. Like I, you know, have written up posts that I thought would be very popular and ended up like, you know, there's no interest. And you start asking yourself, well, am I not interesting, or is the algorithm off and doesn't like me? Right. And I think that it takes you, there's no way to start with being a popular poster. I think it sort of requires you to write. It requires you to experiment and to play, because it really has to touch a chord with the audience. Otherwise, you're kind of ringing hollow. For anyone who has tried and not worked, I think it's worth continuing to try.
I would say that, you know, if you, this is, I don't find, you know, after a year of creating content, I don't think it's a good idea to write a post with the idea of going viral. Because if you want to go viral, or if you want to go reach a big audience, you know, in the start, you're setting yourself up for failure. Initially, if I were to advise my, you know, myself of 1 year ago, I would tell that Mushtaq that you don't have to create, and you know, this is a rule that I stick to this day, and I've seen many big creators also, you know, use this. The idea should be to create a library of content, and you know, your content, it doesn't have to be your post doesn't have to be super useful. It may not appear super useful in the first attempt. That's okay. We all, you know, we all have chances to iterate. But try to create a library, a repository for yourself of content that, you know, there are 10, 20, 50 posts that I have. And then read them and see what's working and why, and what's not working and why not. And then try to rewrite those posts. So, you know, it's a process of continuous iterations that you should be very comfortable doing. I was very comfortable doing it because I knew the process. I had a very good understanding of how the process of academic writing worked. I had taken a lot of seminars and workshops. So I knew that, you know, when I published my first article, it took like 10 drafts and like 1 year and a half. And it was so much of, you know, rewriting it. And that journal article is not a Twitter thread of 20 tweets. It's like 8,000 words. And then you send it out to reviewers and everybody has funny things to say. And, you know, rewrite this, structural changes. I ended up rewriting like 3,000-4,000 words of it. You know, it was, I didn't resent it, but that really taught me a good, you know, good lesson that iterations work. Yeah.
And I think the other thing is to keep in mind is that, you know, yes, the numbers that, you know, you have been, that the number of followers and the number of people who are commenting and liking your posts are quite incredible. I mean, it's a testament to the quality, but not everyone needs to reach. It's not always about quantity, right? If you have a very specific audience that you want to reach, you know, you're talking to all scientists, you know, and all scientists can help, but you may be a researcher in, you know, modern history or in classics. And your goal is not to get, you know, folks from sociology to comment on your post. It's really to bring something of meaning and value to your specific audience and to your community. In a meaningful way. If you want that community to be a wide tent, there's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't have to be in order to be successful. And you know, and maybe this is a good segue to ask you kind of, you know, what do you see as the price that you pay, whether it's in time or, you know, energy? How much time and energy do you put into, you know, these posts that you're working on? And do you ever, you know, do you think it ever comes at the expense of your academic work, or do you see it as complementary?
I'd say it's complementary because, it's complementary, but it's definitely work. It's not something that you can say, hey, it's my hobby. I get up, and you know, if I'm feeling inspired, I'd write a thread. No, it's not. I mean, this is serious work. If you want to make yourself, if you want to provide value to your community, and I want to touch, you know, go back to what you were saying earlier, the idea of building an online community is, you know, one way of thinking about building an audience is to not think about building an audience. You don't want, you know, every day you should not have this in the front and center of your mind that I'm building an audience. No, the idea should be that you're serving a community. That community could be 10 people. That's it. Not a big deal. Like for myself, I have an avatar of a first year freshman, sophomore, undergraduate student who's willing, smart, intelligent, and willing to learn from me. That's my ideal reader, and I write for her or him. That is the reader I write. And so that's one reason that my threads, I my threads are never peevish. My threads are never trying to get back at somebody or trying too hard to be, you know, to prove a point or being defensive, because I'm imagining a very willing reader for my threads, and that helps me, you know, keep that helps me stay grounded. But it also helps me figure out that I'm not writing this to build a community. Building a community or building an audience is a byproduct of the kind of value you will provide to that imagined reader. You know, you have to be sincere to that imagined reader, or and in a way to your own self. And if you stay sincere to that reader, your community would coalesce sooner or later. You don't have to worry about, and you know, in online communities or in this kind of work, growth is exponential. I wrote for the first 3 to 4 months, I had like less than 10,000 followers. Then I wrote a thread on Zotero. It got me like 1,000 followers. Then I followed it up with another very lengthy tutorial that was like 30 tweets long. And that brought me like 7,000 followers in a day. And the next day, I posted a thread in September, I think. The next day, that same thread was being talked about and discussed in classes in Denmark, in US, in the US, in Canada, in many other parts of the world. So what I would say is that, you know, forget about the numbers. If you're starting out, forget about the numbers. You know, you should worry about the numbers, but once you have a sizable community, like if you have 100,000 followers on one of the platforms, then you should worry about numbers, because now it's a different stage of the game. But initially, you should focus on providing quality content.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so I totally agree with everything you're saying, but I do want to push you a little bit and ask you, now that you have been able to experience some success, now that you have been able to gain a following, what's the end goal for Mushtaq, right? Meaning where do you want to see this going? Obviously continuing to create, helpful content and reach researchers that need this help around the world. But do you see this as something that you can actually pursue in, career direction, or do you see it as kind of, or are you still taking it day by day and, you know, seeing where it leads?
Yeah, that's a question that I can answer on two levels, strategic and tactical. So, you know, long term, strategic would be my own idea, and that's why I'm a humanities scholar. So, the good thing about being a humanities scholar is that whatever you learn or whatever the knowledge that you create is immediately applicable to the society that you're living in, to your own self. Of course, it would take, a bit of work to figure out how to do that, how to apply that. Strategically, I had always wanted to do something, some work along the lines of being, you know, public intellectual, somebody who has one foot in academia and the other foot in public discourse and is able to marry the two fields and, you know, is able to communicate scholarly ideas that are grounded in rigorous research, but are also accessible to the public, general public. So strategically, I would I would love to continue this work. And, you know, if it helps me become a public intellectual with a bigger reach, that would be really wonderful. Technically, and I do take these things day at a time. If you ask me on any given day, what's your tomorrow's thread going to be about? And I'll say, I have no idea. I don't worry about it. I write a thread and, you know, in the evening, when I exercise, I think about what I should write about the next day. Then I take a shower, you know, mull it over. In the morning, I get up early in the morning and then I play around with a couple of ideas, write a thread, then forget about it. And then, you know, I do my own, you know, research and house chores and other things. So I take it day by day, but there is also a strategic sort of a vision, you know, my personal vision. And I would love to be able to, you know, continue doing this kind of work because it's far more meaningful to be read by thousands of people across the world than sitting in your room and writing a very rarefied piece of scholarship that only three people would read. I mean, there is, of course, there is a high in that also that, you know, you're able to create such cutting edge scholarship that, on, you know, that's right. That's so useful for your colleagues in the field that there is no doubt about it. But that, you know, you also want to reach a larger audience.
A lot of, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a lot of the more recent success or the more recent strategic help that you've been giving people is really around AI. I wonder if you see AI as a way to bridge that gap in some ways between the theoretical high level, highfalutin academics and the, you know, world, the kind of moving past the ivory tower and being able to reach larger audiences.
Yeah, the work that I'm doing around AI, most of the work comes out of the place or comes out of a place of concern because people and academia, there are two types of groups. One group is very skeptical and, you know, they are like the AI is going to corrupt the system and we won't be able to teach our students what writing is thinking and they're cheating and, you know, all that sort of skeptical or doomer sort of discourse. The other, on the other end of the spectrum are early adopters of AI in academia, somebody like, you know, myself. And my concern is that sooner or later, we are going to have to adapt and adopt these technologies in our pedagogical scholarly research practices. Now, it's only a matter of time, and those who will do it sooner will obviously have an advantage, you know, early adopters advantage. That's one aspect. The second aspect, the concern is that a lot of people don't know how to use these apps. So, for example, there's a professor in Texas A&M. He suspected that his students were cheating, and it was all over Reddit and Twitter and, you know, any social media platform that you can name. And that professor thought his students were cheating, and he opened an account and he ran all his students' assignments through ChatGPT, asking ChatGPT if it had written it. And ChatGPT's initial, you know, the home screen says that ChatGPT can give you wrong information. Now, this professor obviously ignored this and said that ChatGPT had told him that all the assignments were written by ChatGPT, and he failed the whole class. And now these are the students, this is the whole senior class that has graduated. They had graduated and now their graduation is being delayed. This is just enormous. And then yesterday I was reading about a lawyer who looked up fake references in ChatGPT and then filed those fake references in a court file. Could you imagine that? I mean, this is such, and you know, sometimes I feel that every week I write a thread on, please don't use ChatGPT don't ask any references. Don't ask ChatGPT for any citations because it'll just give you fake references to papers that don't even exist. And I think that I'm tired of it now. But then I see a post and I'm like, oh my God, people need to be educated. So this is the second concern, is that, you know, there is going to be a lot of, you know, there's going to be a lot of requirement for AI literacy. There are these apps, but you have to figure out how to use them. They're not, you know, they're not robots. You know, overlords who are going to rule us. They are mere tools. So you need to be able to learn. You need to be able to have a good understanding of them to use them.
I totally resonate with what you're saying, Mushtaq. When I get up to speak about GPT, sometimes I feel like I'm the one who's pushing everybody to think about, you know, what responsible AI looks like and how to use it the best. And sometimes I feel like I'm the one who needs to hit the brakes and say, okay, let's not go overboard here. And I think it only comes from a lot of tinkering and playing around and really understanding what the power and weaknesses of these tools are to be able to, you know, to utilize them for good. But I think you're right. It starts on the one hand from fear, and on the other hand from, like, you know, maybe irresponsibility or a way to cut corners. And it's a matter of teaching people how to use those responsibly. So I'm curious about, you know, kind of, you know, when I was thinking about how to introduce you, I had a number of, like, kind of titles that went through my mind. Academic being the first one, you know, definitely earned your doctor title. But then also, you know, influencer, consultant. I think a lot of people would probably see you as, like, you know, a helpful consultant to them, even if you're not, you know, working with them privately, or content creator. Are there any titles that you kind of prefer, or more or less? And how do you kind of see yourself? Not that you need to ever put yourself in a box, but how do you define your work?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, these labels, because I come from a, you know, literary background, and the understanding, my view of the world is very grounded in sort of a, you know, how literature works. So these are the labels that people use back in the 19th century. And even now, publishers use these labels because they have to sell something. They have to sell a book. And if they have to sell a book, they need a genre. So the genre of the novel is right in at the intersection of art and commerce. You know, it's equally, in equal measure, it is influenced by art and commerce. And I would extrapolate the same thing to my own situation, that I'm at the intersection of academia and a social media content creator. And there are many other people also who are creating great, great, really wonderful content. There's a PhD candidate at Harvard, Kareem Carr, who writes about stats. And he writes about statistics in a very easy to understand, you know, manner, that people could understand how stats are manipulated to create truth. You know, I can give you a statistical truth and you'll be like, oh, wow, this is based in rigorous research, when it could easily be in bad faith, you know. So that's a very useful skill in today's world to have, you know. And I don't do anything with stats, but I find that content super useful. I would say I still think of myself as academic, and if I were to brand myself, you know, so to speak, I'll brand myself as a public intellectual and social media. I mean, social media content creator is also a label that I don't mind. The label of influencer was not something that I used for myself, and I don't use for myself even now. This is a label that other people will use for you, because when somebody will reach out to you and they'll say, Mushtaq, we have this app that we are working on. Could you maybe write a thread about it? And so that's one way of influencing, you know, quote unquote, public opinion. The other is consultant. Consultant is something that I would... Consultant is good. I had never thought about being a consultant, but thank you for this insight, because consultant is a good way of branding myself, because that makes, you to be able to charge a lot of money for your work. You know, so if you're consulting with, say, a bank, you could easily ask them that, yeah, you're going to work for them, but, you know, you'll charge like $2,000 an hour. So that's a good way of branding myself. And speaking of, you know, being a consultant, I have been approached by banks, nonprofits, and, you know, small businesses who are outside of the traditional academia, as you and I would understand. You know, so a development bank wants me to do a workshop for them because they do a lot of writing and they have people with PhDs in social sciences who run these statistical analyses, and they want to be able to use AI apps. And then they thought that, hey, Mushtaq knows a bit about, you know, academia and a bit about this AI apps, so let's hire him. So I think that that consultant is something that I should put in my LinkedIn profile. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm happy to speak further off air about how to turn some of the wonderful work that you do into good business for yourself, because in the end, everything, right, it has to be sustainable and it has to be something that makes sense for you and your family. So that's really quite important. Now, I feel like I could sit here and chat with you all day, but I'm respectful of your time. So I want to skip ahead a little bit and ask you about how, you know, Twitter can be known also for being a wonderful place for quick and helpful information, but also a place with a lot of vitriol and a lot of trolls, you know, who may, you know, be more disruptive and give a hard time or be counterproductive. How do you kind of approach, do you have that issue, first of all, right? Have you had issues where people have kind of like, you know, taken your words out of context or, you know, used them in purposes that you wouldn't be happy with? And how do you kind of deal with that both practically and maybe also emotionally, not to get yourself, you know, too upset when those things happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that is a question that not anybody in the world would have a satisfactory answer to, not even Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, you know, people who run these companies, because it is such a fundamental and simple question, and yet it is so difficult to answer. My own approach has been so this question has two parts. One is that if there is a troll that is, you know, obviously a troll, somebody is posting a hateful comment, somebody doesn't follow you, they don't have their photo, or they have a fake photo or a fake, you know, made up Twitter handle, non-serious user of Twitter, and they post a hateful comment, it's very easy to deal with them. You just mute them or block them. You don't have to engage with them. That's not that big of a deal. But the real challenge for somebody like me is when I write for academics and people deliberately misunderstand or project their readings onto my work, and that is often done in bad faith. And so, for example, I'll give you an example of a while back. I did a thread on how to find journals for your work. So if you're starting out, if you're a first year student and you have a paper on the horizon that you want to publish, you know, maybe 2 years down the line, 1 year down the line, you have no idea how journal submissions work. And I wrote a thread on, you know, tools, that 10, 12 tools that you can use to find the best possible match. Of course, when you're done with the PhD and you have been in the field for a few years, then you automatically know that these are the journals where your work would be a good fit because you've been reading those journals for years. But when you're starting out, you're just trying to find your feet. So I did a thread, and there's a bunch of academics wrote that there is no need to have this kind of a thread, because we just know how to publish this. And I thought that, hey, you're not understanding what I'm trying to say here. It's not meant for you. You're not the audience of this thread. And I used to tell people that, you know, you're not the audience. Now I've stopped doing that because I think my time is not the best possible utilization of my time. But there is no doubt about the fact that academics can be very mean people on Twitter. I wrote a thread on systematic review. I don't do systematic reviews because it's essentially done in biomedical research. And I'm a humanities scholar, but somebody asked me that, hey, Mushtaq, we are developing an app for systematic review. Could you maybe advise us? And I said, let me see what systematic reviews are. So I read up a bit about it and wrote a thread on it that this is what I've learned. And medical librarians, they were really vicious about it. They were like, hey, why are you writing about systematic reviews? You're a humanities scholar. No, you should not even write this. And maybe there is a bit of a turf, you know, protecting your turf that, hey, this is our turf. Don't come on it. So maybe that goes on. But that's okay. I mean, it's par for the course. It comes with the territory.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like you do a good job of not getting distracted. And I think that's part of, you know, you probably can't be successful if you're going to take everything to heart, and you have to realize that with numbers will come all sorts of, you know, unexpected surprises, and you kind of have to stay the course and, you know, and be able to tune it out at the end of the day as well. Mushtaq, yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to add one thing quickly. When I started out, there's a colleague, Jo Van Avery, on Twitter. She's in the UK, and she wrote under one of my comments. Okay, so another thing that I want to add here is that when I started out on Twitter, there's a colleague in the UK. Her name is Jo Van Avery, and I started following her, you know, as soon as I started my Twitter account. She told me in response to one of the hateful comments under my threads, she said that, Mushtaq, you don't have... She said, Mushtaq, remember two things. Nobody can tell you how to use your Twitter account. You are free to post whatever you want to. And the second thing is, these are not your people. If people who post these hateful comments, they are not your people. And that has stuck with me ever since, and I still remind myself every time I read a hateful comment or overly, you know, criticism for the sake of criticism, I read it and then I say to myself, Mushtaq, they are not my people. That's a very useful way of understanding online communities, because you're writing for a specific community. If somebody is not part of the community, and not everybody will be that part of the, you know, even the biggest creator on social media, like Mr. Beast, somebody like Mr. Beast will have people who are not part of his community, you know? And so that should not make any difference to a serious social media content creator. You know, you're writing for your community. It's sort of like preaching to the converted, which sounds counterintuitive, but it makes a lot of sense. You're writing for people who are already convinced that you bring value to the community.
Right. Interesting. And I think you can probably say that community can be made up not just of interests, but also of values, right? So if someone is not acting in accordance with the values of that community and the respect that is part of that environment and culture that you've built online, then they're not part of the community.
That is correct.
Fantastic. All right, here's what I want to do, Mushtaq, because we're already at about time, but I want to get the last section of this interview was going to be about practical things that researchers can do, and I don't want to skip out on that. Here's what I want to recommend. Are you up for doing a lightning round? I'll ask you some questions. We'll try to do up to 30-second answers, and we'll just run through them quickly. Does that work for you?
Sure. Let's see.
Okay, let's try it. We'll experiment. We'll see how it goes. All right. So number one, tell us something about things you've noticed about themes or content that works particularly well or does not work well.
Yeah, how-tos. As far as I'm concerned, if you tell people, academics, how to do XYZ using a tool ABC, that content will work very well. Content that doesn't work well. If you write personal stories, and I sometimes do that, you know, that content doesn't work as well. But hey, sometimes you write not for, you know, for your readers, but for your own self. So that doesn't do well in terms of numbers.
Got it. How can scientists do a better job of communicating their research, both within academia as well as to the general public?
Oh, that's a great question. People need to write books on it. I think one of the ways but I will keep it very brief. The most important and fundamental thing for any scientist to wrap their head around, or, you know, so a natural scientist or a humanities scholar, is that is not to look down upon readers, general readers, not to say that these people are maybe dumb or they won't understand my research. This is like a cardinal sin. It's not that they can't understand. It's just that it's our job to make the scholarship palatable for as many people as possible. You know, I think it was Feynman who said that if you cannot explain a concept to a 13-year-old or a 12-year-old, it means you haven't understood it perfectly yourself.
Yeah, 100%. What would you say to more introverted scholars who maybe are afraid to expose themselves online?
Oh, that's a great question. I am somewhat of an introvert in a specific sense of the word, because, you know, English is not my first language, and writing in English is, you know, like putting myself out there for, you know, I feel somebody's looking over my shoulder, you know, and, you know, there's a constant sense of being judged by native speakers. But introverted scholars, I would say that, you know, being able to communicate your thoughts in a manner that you feel comfortable is a very important skill. And you can start low stakes. Start really low stakes. If you're an introverted person and you don't want to put yourself out there initially, you can go to Quora. A lot of people have asked questions there. You can create a simple profile and you can answer their questions. You know, you can offer your considered opinion. And if what you have to say, if that resonates with other, then you can, you know, you can think about putting yourself out there in a much more explicit manner. But start small.
I like that. Answering specific questions on specific fora. That's great. All right. And maybe most importantly, for those few researchers that don't yet follow you on social media, what's the best way to give you a follow and be able to consume your content?
So you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Mushtaq Bilal, PhD, MushtaqBilal, PhD. And the same handle I have on LinkedIn. So I'm actually on Twitter and LinkedIn at the moment. I'm thinking of going to Facebook, but there's only so many hours in a day and so much you can do.
I don't recommend. We can talk about this, but I think you're in exactly where you should be, and I don't know that you even need to get to Facebook. I think you've done a great job both those places. So brilliant, Mushtaq. This has been really, really informative and wonderful. I think it really sheds a light on what I think will be increasingly significant and important venue and means and medium for having these discussions. And I think you're right in that the early adopters and folks who at least educate themselves, play around with these tools. You don't have to fall in love with each and every one. You don't even have to use them. But to understand the value of both the modern tools, but also the modern venues, will have a leg up and will really be able to flourish in ways that they couldn't have imagined prior. So Mushtaq, thank you so much for taking the time to share some of your knowledge with us today. And I look forward to continuing these conversations down the line.
Thank you, Avi. Thank you for inviting me. It was wonderful having a conversation with you, and I wish you the best.